Cameron McCune and Bob Dawes with the 36th episode of our discussion of my new book slash pamphlet. And we're discussing something about the beginning of the Winnipeg School of Communication, and I claim that Pitchers is not a school. And I was saying that in response to Cameron, quoting McLuhan, saying that art can't work as what? An anti-environment? What would you say? You can finish the thought.
Today. No, I think art can function as an anti-environment, but the big question concerns what exactly an environment and an anti-environment amount to. And that's something that art can't decide. And that's because art, at least as it's practiced in the contemporary world, is arbitrary.
Yeah, say that again. What was it? Did you say art and environment and environment? I missed the dialectic there. Say it again.
Yeah, I said that I think that art can be an anti-environment. I think it's very good as an anti-environment. But what art can't do is provide an intelligible account of what an environment and an anti-environment amount to. That is to say, art can depict, but it's not good at clarifying its right to depict.
It's right.
Yeah. In other words, the artist has to sign the picture. The poet has to sign the poem. So what the artist or the poet does, or the movie maker when he or she has stopped filming, what has happened in all of those cases is that the manufacturer, we could say, has designated something as being an artifact, something that has been produced and finalized. So then if we ask, well, what if the artist in all of those senses has to clarify what it means to be an artist? So then the artist has to sign what it means to be an artist, and it doesn't work, of course, right? Because what is supposedly being signed, sort of the right to be an artist, has as its ground only the right to be an artist. Right? I don't know if that makes sense, but it relates to what we've talked about actually from the very beginning of your book, and that is that the modern world has collapsed into a kind of cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
And that it doesn't, the contemporary world has no handle on itself or where it's going or how it could get out of the cul-de-sac. It's a fly in a fly bottle. And the artist is not able to provide help in that situation because the help that the artist would provide depends upon the artist. So it's what McLuhan called signing a counterfeit check.
Yeah, and that's the meaning of the title, 1970, Cultures Are Business. Art is the waiting for Godot. Art is just sitting there waiting. So while people wait to get out of the cul-de-sac, they're titillated by art, kind of what Neil Postman says, simply amusing ourselves to death. The arts have become the means of conventional wealth, distracting wealth or numbing wealth.
Sure.
All the
But that, that, that doesn't that's true, but that doesn't mean that art can't be used to kind of juggle our situation and to probe our situation. That it can do as an anti-environment. It's just that art is in the same cul-de-sac as the world, and so it can't get out as art. And if art were to provide or to signal a way out of the cul-de-sac, it wouldn't be art anymore. It would be something else. And that's kind of the interesting problem for art, is how to signify beyond itself.
Yeah, McLuhan celebrates that by posing the amateur against the professional.
Yes.
So I used to call it little A art. Professional art, commercial art is the art game, is capital art. It's what Baudrillard in his book calls the conspiracy of art. That's capital A, mm-hmm. That's capital A art. Little art is what McLuhan did. He was an amateur in the traditional Gutenberg arts, but he knew how to turn that into an anti-environment. I'm an amateur.
Right, so
I went on the radio with no talent of any arts and just started talking. And I created a great anti-environment with that. Well, I predicted the anti-environment I was going to get to, which I had no clue what it was going to be until I got there. But
sure. Well, that's the only way to get anywhere.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. If you know where you're going, it's going to be wrong.
Yeah. Yes, and McLuhan says that. I like to quote this in his first essay in Explorations Number 1, Culture Without Literacy. He talks about the seminar group, where he implies it's them, and he says, we will have a dialogue. And he might say that will be circular, but he said, but we will reserve the right for self-correction. You remember that line?
Yes.
Something
and
like that.
And, yes. And but sort of the background to that is that McLuhan felt that of the five editors, four of them were convinced Gutenbergians.
Yeah.
And so what he was saying is we deserve the right for self-criticism and for basically making a U-turn. That was his hope, that there would be enough dialogue that they would be able to get at least some of those folks out of the Gutenbergian perspective into a digital or electronic one.
They'd
but by
correct.
1955, he had given up on that idea.
I'm correcting them. He called it self-correction.
Yeah, I'm very happy to let that go.
Hey, there's not much of an echo, right? We're okay on the echo?
For me, there's no echo at
all. Good, all right. So, I don't think I interpreted it that way. I just thought it was interesting that it was an open-ended seminar. In a sense, they didn't know where it was going to get to. So they would correct some of the directions they thought they were going in if new evidence pointed, well, we got to do this, not that.
Right.
So,
but that was that's a strategic intervention by McLuhan, right? Because you can what you just said can be taken in a sort of normalized academic way. Well, let's go and investigate, and make experiments and all that. People accept that. That's great. That's why we're at the university here. But what McLuhan meant, something completely different. What he meant is we want to overturn your whole way of thinking.
Yeah.
And, of course, what people found is that when they got halfway down the road that McLuhan was trying to lead them on, then they said, no, we're not going to do that. And that's how the seminar ended.
Yeah.
And there's a letter that McLuhan wrote. I forget the guy's name, a guy down at the University of Florida who is a Catholic like McLuhan. And McLuhan said, well, you should pray for the possibility of Carpenter converting to Catholicism, right? So, and I think this was 1956.
Mm.
So I think that McLuhan felt that there was the possibility of at least one person coming around to sort of his point of view, or his complex points of view, plural, in 1956. But then, of course, Carpenter did not convert and did not, in the end, really understand the full program that McLuhan was promoting.
Right, and I may have mentioned this to you before. It was, he had a TV show in Toronto in 55, 56, and then he got caught having an affair. So there was a scandal, and he divorced his wife. I think that's what McLuhan might be praying for, or what triggered his this statement, praying for Carpenter because he got in trouble. In the
maybe, but I think the letter is pretty specific. He's praying for his he asks for prayers for his conversion.
Okay.
So Carpenter may have got himself into a problem like you're talking about, and that problem may have opened him up to the possibility of conversion.
Yeah.
Right? He may have thought, holy shit, what have I got myself into now?
Yeah.
And McLuhan might have said, well, you know, if you really want to think about this stuff, you should become a Catholic, because we don't think about these things in black and white terms.
Yeah. Okay, so so you were agreeing with me that pictures or art, especially pictures, McLuhan was, his stated goal of subplot was to make books relevant. He came up with a very complex reason why he was going to write books. And so he was retrieving the verbal and the literate abstract as an anti-environment to the overwhelming pictorial, which was dominating the 20th century. So pictures, in that sense, can't be a school. And I mean by a school something that is instructive, didactic, or some kind of anti-environment, a serious investigation of the situation, not doing commercial art, or art, capital A art, amateur art, as an anti-environment.
Okay, you're touching on a very important point here, and that is that McLuhan had, by the early 50s, he already had a notion of culture being dominated by certain sets of the senses. And he, along with that, he had the notion that what had happened to the United States in the 20th century was the development of what you might call counter-visualism. So comic books, film, advertising, all of these things are extremely visual.
Mm.
So McLuhan had the problem in the for, let's say, 5 or 6 years in the 1950s, where on the one hand, he was equating the Gutenberg galaxy, or the Gutenberg era, as he called it then, with visuality. But on the other hand, he was thinking that the new visuality was going to overturn the Gutenberg galaxy. And of course, and he got all screwed up between different kinds of visuality,
yeah,
you could say. And so what was liberating to him with the acoustic space that they came up with in the seminar in 1954 was that it gave him a new way to talk about what was going on with comic books, advertising, and film that got away from the visual.
Yeah.
Right. So it allowed him to clarify his mind, and that clarification then led him a couple of years later to The Medium as the Message and to the whole Understanding Media Project with the National Association of Educational Broadcasters.
Yeah, and you said he got to a deeper understanding of tactility in that period.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You see, he had to get clear about the different kinds of visuality in order to understand tactility correctly.
Right. So you would commonly hear, well, since the 60s, the average person saying, you know, we live in a more and more visual society. And then if you imagine, if you got around to saying, you ought to read McLuhan, and they started to, you knew they'd get all screwed up over the word visual. They'd be reading the book of visual space, and that we were in somewhere different from the Gutenberg, which to them was more visual. So how could we be, you know, non-Gutenberg in the Marconi galaxy? You know, that's visual space. So that was the first cul-de-sac that people encountering McLuhan got into, the word visual.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
you're right.
And but he himself had been, for let's say 1950 or 1949 to 1955 or 1956, that was a problem he had.
Yeah. And he, you know, TV was just starting to come in. It hadn't become a visual society yet for most people. That's probably not, TV visuality was not until the 60s for people, because television was pretty slow in the 50s, methodical, even though it was live, which had, had an extra dimension to it. Would you agree with the idea that in the 60s, when live TV stopped, that was TV being turned into an art form, the way McLuhan defined art form, that cycle?
Maybe. I've never thought about that, but that's true. As soon as something is not live, then its reproduction needs to be signed. Somebody needs to take responsibility for that.
Yeah.
And when you take responsibility for what goes on and when it goes on, then that becomes an art form, sure.
That's ecology. That's understanding or working with the programming, as you understand what programming is. So McLuhan said, you know, let's turn off television for 6 weeks, 6 months. Well, it was done on a technical level of getting rid of the live aspect, but that was still within the realm of content, so it wasn't the kind of ecology he wanted. He wanted the form shut off, not just the content. So
right.
It was,
and of course, in order to begin to manipulate forms, you need to know what a form is. And so that's when he says the medium is the message, what he's saying is if media are dominant factors in human history, and if we want to begin to understand them, then our first task is to understand what a medium is.
Mm.
So the medium is the message.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's one of the meanings of culture is our business.
Yeah.
That's a phrase with about 20 different meanings, but probably its most important meaning is that human beings are cultural animals. And so our main business on this earth is culture.
Yeah. Okay, and that's should be ongoing, explored, what culture is. You know, it's
absolutely.
Not, yeah. Okay, so I sent to go to another critical point before we get into the book. I sent you a recent interview with Derek DeKirchhoff, and I
right.
wanted to point this out. Let's see, you got question one, question two, question three, and a long answer, and he says, presently, in books that I am writing now, very much under the McLuhan influence and the figure ground probe, I am working on two great competing, not to say conflicting, grounds of the present human condition. Language, and in brackets, and literacy on one hand, with its principal figure, that is meaning, and, on the other hand, the so-called digital transformation, with algorithms that do not need meaning, that do not need meaning at all to be efficient and now run our lives. That is a really big contrast, and the evidence is the serious epistemological crisis that the spread of quote, fake news, unquote, and science denials the world over is imposing on everybody. We will overcome neither the pandemic nor the threats of climate change before we resolve this crisis of shared meaning across the planet. As you can see, I'm here to save the world. Now, this is an example of Derek's sloppy thinking, sloppy perception, sloppy expression, which I've criticized him doing since the 80s. This is not McLuhan's method, if he's trying to be something like McLuhan. McLuhan would not try to resolve the argument over what's news or fake news, or that someone is denying science. He would explain why that became an issue, not over, us academics are being denied by the hoi polloi who don't know what science is anymore, and they don't know that we are in a serious ecological crisis, you know, which is what happened under Trump. The alt-right did not go along with the idea that there was climate change and something else. And that's the iconic alt-right. Who knows what the alt-right really is? It's millions of people posting it.
It's not just the alt-right. It's also the alt-left and the alt-center. There's increasing consciousness in the world that science and insight and academic degrees can be used to exercise power. And people are getting sick of people, like de Kerckhoff says here, that I'm going to save the world. Just let me run everything. And I'm going to do it because I have superior insight.
Yes.
And people of every political persuasion are calling bullshit on that.
Yeah.
They're saying, don't try and leverage how smart you are as signed by you. This, here we're back at the counterfeit check, right?
Yes.
To take our money and to run things. That's exactly why the world's in such shit.
I know. And so here's this Chinese guy, you know, impressed with McLuhan and then therefore Derek, because he was at the center and replaced McLuhan, took over. And he's looking for insight about McLuhan, and Derek has a great opportunity to do and say things like you're saying or what I'm saying, but he falls back into his cultural blindness. And do you get my point, though? McLuhan would explain why science denial it has become a trend, not, oh, we've got to correct science denial. You got to, in other words, McLuhan would define the problem in a different way, which would not allow you to have knee-jerk superiority
right.
battles.
Well, I think that's what we just did.
Yes. Yes. No, I'm saying.
Yeah.
So I have only read that far in the interview. But, again, Derek has muddied this situation, and he needs to be corrected. And I probably will excerpt this part, what we just said, and post it on his Facebook page. But meanwhile, you've read it all, and you said you have some problems with it. Do you want to say, maybe not too much, but anything you want to say, like I just wanted to say? Do you have something in the interview, if you just scan it? What?
No, I didn't. I read the interview, but I didn't find anything too interesting about it. The only interesting things about it are criticisms that can be made, like the one that you just made. The whole idea of I'm here to save the world. I mean, it's almost laughable that somebody can have that point of view these days. Haven't we had enough people saving the world in the 20th and 21st centuries?
Wow.
Scary stuff.
Right. I just scanned down. He makes a comment on me. Let's look at this. Question 10. Well, you would have read this. You have taught at the Chinese guy says, you have taught at the university, I'm assuming he's Chinese, you have taught at the University of Toronto in Canada and at the Polytechnical Institute of Milan in Italy. How does McLuhan research in Canada and Italy compare with that in the United States? So he says, Derek says, the good news is that after having conspued McLuhan, conspued, I don't know, expressed McLuhanism, conspired, spewed, having conspued McLuhan for decades before and after his death, the University in Toronto and Canada in general have come to their senses and begun to see the value of his work. So maybe conspued was, you know, put down McLuhan. The University of Toronto and Canada have seen the value of his work. There is a growing concentration of McLuhan scholars everywhere, but particularly stemming from Toronto with extremely rich Facebook communities that are international. Among others, the highlighting of McLuhan's work has benefited greatly from three firebrands. One from Italy, Paolo Granata, who, one could say, was compelled to emigrate to Toronto from Bologna to get closer to McLuhan's heritage that he promotes with brio. Another, also in Toronto, Alex Kuskas, who tills the McLuhan fire on Facebook with extremely valuable and astute miscellaneous bits of wisdom and anecdotes by and on McLuhan. And Marshall's own grandson, Andrew McLuhan. So that's Paola, Alex, and Andrew. Andrew McLuhan, who carefully reviews his grandfather's works and turns them into public lectures and online courses, followed by a growing community of fans. There are others, of course. For instance, Bob Logan, my old friend and colleague, an unofficial co-founder of the McLuhan Program, in brackets, he didn't actually do that, but thanks to him and Marshall's son, Eric McLuhan, getting together with me at and after Marshall's funeral in January 1981, he died on the last day of 1980. In the last day of 1980, we all three took the decision to continue the Monday night seminars and do everything we could to keep the McLuhan name and the Center for Culture and Technology alive and thriving at the University of Toronto. And that we did, against all odds. And then further afield, what's that mean, further afield, like off in left field? and then further afield, in many ways, I must name Bob Dobbs, who, in spite of quirks of his own, and you knew this, you read this, and you didn't tell me, right? Or you missed it. Did you read this?
Well, I don't find any of this sort of stuff very interesting. It doesn't register with me as something that requires comment.
Okay, Bob Dobbs, who, in spite of quirks of his own and a weird commitment to some ghostly online figure called Ion, has amassed a formidable database or database. Do you say data or data? What do you say?
Database. I say database.
Has amassed a formidable database on McLuhan, as well as interviewing many scholars and other people friendly to the McLuhan tradition that he makes available as radio shows in quotes, and online too. That's nice that he mentions it, but badly stated, and I am not at all that, and McLuhan and Ion is not an online figure. Anyways, no one's ever going to get that. And Derek's been on the show. I've interviewed, and he's dialogued with Ion, and I thought that was great that he did it, and I thought he should have continued, but for some reason he stopped. So he then says, as far as Italy is concerned.
Why do you think that it's interesting or complimentary or anything else to be mentioned in something like this? I don't get that.
Oh, this is status land. This is academia. And to mention me is illegal. You're not allowed to mention me. I've even been deleted from the Figure Ground Journal because academics complained about me. I mean, I think it's very nice that Derek brings me up, and his general acknowledgement of what I've done, other than the Ion stuff, is accurate. I've done that. As a matter of fact, I could claim that I speared the McLuhan revival in the mid-'80s with Nelson on CKLN, and that led to Mondo 2000 guys picking up on us. Mary met them, and then that led to Wired to counter the Mondo 2000 gang, and they made McLuhan their patron saint. But the Mondo 2000 gang got into McLuhan through me and Nelson. And we were doing it in the period when nobody was interested in McLuhan in the 80s. So that certainly would not be true for academia, but like you say, who the hell are those guys? they didn't do anything. I got the word McLuhan out there for the Generation Xers and younger more than anybody else. Just because I was on college radio. And, many people through the years, have thanked me saying, hey, I never would have heard of McLuhan unless I heard your ridiculous show. Your crazy show. So it's nice of Derek to mention me in an academic setting. So that's okay. But let's see what he says. Since you find the McLuhan industry disgusting, let's see. This is what he's talking about. So he says, as far as Italy is concerned, it has been friendly to McLuhan from the start and has never defamed him as the French did at the beginning, calling him a charlatan, and Guy Debord stating that McLuhan was the most convinced imbecile of his time. And he has the French version, l'imbécile le plus convaincu de son temps. And Debord was saying that just before the fall of the Berlin Wall, an event that McLuhan in many ways would have been able to predict much better than Debord. Then he says, okay, Derek says, okay, peace to the French who have also changed their minds and also learned to respect his legacy. The U.S., on the other hand, either consider McLuhan as an American, and he puts that in quotes, without checking their sources, a way of co-opting famous foreigners who happen to speak English, or they begrudgingly admit that, in spite of being only Canadian, he did make a difference. But their real hero is Neil Postman, who, like many other people across the planet, merely, quote, borrowed McLuhan. But then again, as Picasso is supposed to have said, quote, great artists just steal, the others borrow, end of quote. To be fair, I should add that in New York, around Lance Straight and the media ecology he founded, media ecology quotes, there's a very dynamic McLuhan research group, including Paul Levinson, who wrote several books about Marshall, among which Digital McLuhan and other less-known researchers and students who will eventually emerge. Is that correct? Who wrote several books about McLuhan, among which Digital McLuhan and other lesser-known He wrote books about McLuhan, among which Digital McLuhan, then there should be a comma, and then other lesser-known researchers and students who will eventually emerge. Probably under the influence of McLuhan via Carolyn Marvin, the USC Annenberg School for Communication Journalism has added effects, quote, effects, to the list of main topics of research about communication. And finally, let us remember that until a few years ago, Wired magazine featured McLuhan on their masthead as the patron saint. Patron saint is quote. Now, this is Derek being the university president, nodding to all the departments of the industry and acknowledging everybody, whereas he should be critical of every one of them, especially the New York gang, Levinson and those guys. So that's where, Derek, I guess you would call that being political, right? He's politically savvy or politically congenial to everybody, so that puts you into the switchboard position. You're the guy that will not shake up other institutions that might be interested in McLuhan. You follow what I'm saying here?
Yeah, I follow, but I'm not sure I buy it. Like you said, I'm disgusted by the McLuhan industry, and disgust is the wrong word. My problem with all of this answer here is that in order to start reading McLuhan, you have to know the sorts of problems he was addressing and addressing with passion, and the he wasn't addressing the problem of how to get tenure. He wasn't addressing the problem of how to enrich your CV. He wasn't addressing the problem of how to get grants. He wasn't addressing the problem of how to get mentions in secondary literature or online somewhere. He was passionately interested in the downward spiral of the world into potential destruction, and wondering how that could be avoided.
Mm.
And if you don't start with that problem, and don't get that problem stuck in your craw, then you're not reading McLuhan. You're just mining McLuhan for other purposes.
Yeah, no. Is McLuhan thinking big?
Yeah, but big, not in the sense of the Kirchhoff saying here, you see, I'm trying to save the world and all that. thinking big can mandate thinking very small. And that's because in trying to navigate a way out of the cul-de-sac, it may be that minute analysis must be made in certain ways. Right? So, for example, modern medicine, McLuhan often said, came from doctors beginning to wash their hands. So there was a dawning of doctors to the fact that there are things that can't be seen that can be deadly. And so you have to try to obviate those things in order to do good and in order to help the patient. It's the same thing now. We don't know how to get out of the cul-de-sac. That is the problem of the cul-de-sac. It's being lost. So being lost implicates that we don't know what it would be to think big or to think small. Mm. Those are things that we have to find out. And it's what McLuhan was trying to specify is that in order to think about these things, we have to define matters like media. So he took over the idea from Innes that communication is the key to understanding different cultures. Understand their different modes of communication, you can understand the different cultures. But in order to understand the different communication modes, you have to understand their media. So in Innes, that's like stone engraving or clay or papyrus, et cetera, up onto radio. McLuhan agrees with all of that. Yes, we need to concentrate on communication. The key to communication is the media of communication. But what are media? And so McLuhan is saying we need to have the microscopic analysis of what media are in order to understand the big questions of communication and culture.
Is philosophy a category for thinking big for a certain phase of the history of media, so that you wouldn't call McLuhan a philosopher today? Or do you say the greats who tackled the cul-de-sac were all philosophers? Would you give them that term?
No, they certainly. It's not the case that they people who found a way out of the cul-de-sac were all philosophers. Right? the main way that people have seen to get out of the cul-de-sac is to relativize it, to see the cul-de-sac as only one mode of human experience. So for you have somebody like Shakespeare, who's a great master of different kinds of human experience, he doesn't have any trouble envisioning people who are locked in the cul-de-sac, but at the same time, he envisions people who aren't. And it's that multiple visioning or multiple understanding or multiple hearing of different kinds of experience that we've lost. To be locked into the cul-de-sac means that we do not understand any longer what it would be to relativize it. Mm. So if you look at Amazon Prime movies or Netflix movies, it's very clear that we don't have art anymore. Art is gone from the Western experience.
Well, you mean by art, people getting out of the cul-de-sac?
No, I mean, when people think that they're doing art.
Which is a term that refers to an archetypal epiphany or something. Is this, what do you mean?
No, it just means how can I put this? Hegel said that there are three absolute forms of experience: philosophy, religion, and art. And what is an absolute form of experience is to grapple with the larger issues of human life and to articulate them. And so for Hegel, it was unimaginable that a society could not have all three of these things. But he understood that at his time, he died in 1831 or 1832, I forget which. In his time, philosophy was dying. And so he, I believe it's in the Logic, he talks about the incredible fate of a country that no longer has metaphysics. Well, a century after that, there was no longer any religion. And now a century after that, there's no longer any art. But I'm just talking about in Western civilization, because yeah. I don't think it's true in Russia or in China or in small countries in Asia or countries in South America. I think all of these, philosophy, religion, and art, are still alive in various ways.
But what about philosophy? Did that die? Like art and religion?
Yes. And what Hegel saw was that it was already dead in his time.
Right.
But
so
certainly,
he's dealing with the cancellation of philosophy. Then 100 years later, 1900s, the cancellation of religion. And then the beginning of the 21st century is the cancellation of art. That's
right.
The sequence
right.
there.
And the cancellation of philosophy was sort of signed by Nietzsche.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, what he also foresaw was the death of religion.
Yeah.
And I think it could be argued that Nietzsche also saw the death of art.
Yeah. Yeah. You've had spiraling replays and benefits of a little later after Nietzsche repeating the Nietzsche pattern. So that were thinkers later that saw the death of religion, art, and philosophy. But, I don't know, deeper, like maybe Heidegger or somebody, then McLuhan, maybe Warhol. I don't know. We've been running on the same spot since 1850, since we got into the electric age. So let's say that's an electric realization, and Nietzsche was the first.
Well, let's say that I would prefer to say that electric realization took place mostly in science and culminated in atomic weapons and nuclear weapons. But meanwhile, the wisdom necessary to deal with these advancements in science got derailed, and got derailed in ways that Harold Innes tried to specify in the 19th century, with the takeover of government by media and by bureaucracies and by the economy of weapons. The legacy of the 19th century to the 20th century was that things that are necessary for human culture had gone into eclipse and have been expressed ever since 1914 until the present day in war.
Mm. Yeah. So we're talking about the McLuhan industry and the failure for most people to probe the cul-de-sac.
Correct.
Who are some of the greats that you think did it over the last 3,000 years?
Well, did it would require some definition, of course, but
yeah.
Let's just say that they...
Well, we've been defining it for 36, 35 episodes.
That's right. We're attempting to do that.
Yeah.
But the sign of a great mind is the ability to understand in fundamentally different ways.
So, in different ways, did you say? In fundamentally different ways?
Yeah, in different ways. Yes. So the only way out of the cul-de-sac is to relativize it, to understand that there are other ways of thinking that aren't caught up in the cul-de-sac. Already with Plato, for example, you have him thinking about the different ways or the different, how can I put this, springs, the different origins of thought that are already a plural ontologically. So it just, for Plato, it belongs to human beings to be exposed to different ways of thinking. And in order to solve problems, you need to use that facility of human beings to think differently. But in order to understand that facility, you have to understand that there is a metamorphosis, or there is a tactility, or there is a transition possible, a gap between these different ways. Right? If the ways are fundamentally different, then what is between them is deeper than fundament. It falls through fundament. Right? So you have a kind of black hole in between the different ways of experiencing, and for the great minds, those black holes in between are transitive. The gap is something that does not delimit communication. It's something that enables communication. So once we have seen that, then we can define the cul-de-sac as the conviction that the darkness around the cul-de-sac is not transitive. So death.
What does that mean? Not transitive. What does transitive
mean?
Yeah,
it's transitive, crossable, metaphoric.
Mm. Can't bridge
right?
it.
Right. Transitive means you go across.
Okay.
Right?
Which is the definition of metaphor.
Correct. So when McLuhan talks about the gap all the time, when he talks about metaphor, when he talks about metamorphosis, or he talks about the importance of Ovid, all of these are ways of pointing to the, or he talks about discontinuity. All of these are ways to pointing to how the cul-de-sac can be relativized. So when that's where he starts his thinking. In order to read McLuhan, you have to come from there. But all of the people in the paragraph that we were just talking about know nothing about that, unfortunately. So that means that the McLuhan industry is not starting to, is not even starting to read McLuhan.
Right. Okay.
Go ahead.
No, you can finish. You can finish that sentence, that part of your sentence. But they.
Yeah, they're reducing McLuhan to their understanding.
Right.
But the reverse has to happen. What they need to do is open their understanding to him. Right?
Yeah.
But not because McLuhan is some sort of unique guy in the history of the world. That's the same thing that you have to do to understand anybody that's great.
Right, and I think you're saying that the great are what Harold Bloom did in his later books. Remember, he wrote about the canon. He defended the canon, the Western canon.
Right.
You would accept the greats that are considered the greats and used to be the core of the curriculum 100 years ago in the arts and sciences and philosophy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Greats are the greats. But we have come to an interesting point where the greats are not a service anymore.
Correct. So that's exactly what I was just going to say, is that the curricula, which emphasize certain greats, kind of broke down. And so what's needed is a reinstitution.
Of the great process, maybe. The process of greatness, or just a restating of the original problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes,
sure.
People would go and study the greats and maybe not know what the problem was, just appreciate the creativity of something, the inventiveness, or maybe they saw the problem in abstract. But they were not put in the position of figuring out the problem or encountering the cul-de-sac.
Yeah, well, I would say that the problem of communication, which is not just a question about what is communication, it's also a problem of communicating the problem of communication. Right, so you get into a circle here.
Yeah.
The problem of communicating has probably been known forever. It's probably the kind of problem you have between all grandparents and all teenagers.
Mm.
When Plato looked at the problem and tried to imagine how the academy would work, what he apparently thought was that it's not possible through writing to convey this stuff. It's only possible to do it orally. But then once the person has the idea through oral instruction, then they can understand the writing, and you can bring the orality and the literacy together. But that problem that Plato looked at has gone through all of Western tradition, and has never properly been solved. And now we've gotten ourselves into a tremendous hole where we have these weapons of destruction, and we don't have the wisdom to know how to deal with them.
Right. And on page 31 of Counterblast, where he talks about how arts and sciences at some point cease to be anti-environmental, that's the process you're talking about. The greats, for media reasons, would become opaque, and they couldn't communicate the problem, but they were actually engaging, but it couldn't be transmitted, so you needed a new art or science or another great to bring people back to the problem or the dilemma and the questions. So today, where McLuhan says we have nothing but an ersatz anti-environment, we don't have an anti-environment. And so McLuhan was realizing, we're not going to find out the problem. We've forgotten the problem, which you were just saying a couple minutes ago. We've forgotten the cul-de-sac issue.
Right. Well, it's there's very little difference between we've forgotten it and we've seen it so much in front of us that it scared the hell out of us, and therefore we're not going to think about it.
Yeah. So, okay, so that's, we understand it fits into what we've been saying for 35 shows. We've elaborated our objection to the schools, the McLuhan industry that Derek is a manager of the image of the school. That's what he's become. In Europe, anyways, and some parts of the States, he has been a Smithsonian scholar, I think, one of those institutions of Washington. I don't know of any other McLuhanite who got that that distinction. So he has established a kind of a patina of success in keeping the McLuhan mantle going. But we who take on the cul-de-sac find that that's a misinterpretation of Derek's project. But what do you expect? Nobody knows what the project is anymore.
Right. But I don't want to... the McLuhan school is not wrong in thinking that there is stuff worth preserving in McLuhan.
Right.
So it's not as if these people have just completely misspent their lives and are useless. it's that they have been of great service in one way, but tragically, they at the very time that they have helped to preserve the legacy, they have obscured it.
Yeah.
And that's a very common thing in the history of Western civilization.
Right. So Barry Nevitt used to talk about the archivist, and the archivist is comprehensive. The World Wide Web, Internet, social media world has turned many people into archivists. And so a lot of academia is people scrabbling back to find some obscure somebody that was forgotten, and hook them up and add them to the archive. So that, since our electric knowledge environments are naturally archiving everything, we are imitating that, becoming personal archivists in finding a role in the world of the Android meme. So that's what's the problem. Well, that's another way of talking about the problem, is we have been reduced to archiving. And Coker talks about this in some of his books, the archiving mania. Yeah, so that shows...
Notice it's the same. It's the same problem that we were talking about with art, and that is the the archivist finds something to archive. And with the tools of the internet and the increasing digitalization of everything, people can be quite successful at archiving. But if you then ask, well, who decided that this figure was important, number one, and number two, who decided that these things that have been archived are important to that important figure? And the answer to that is, well, the archivist decided that. Right? And so then you say, well, but where did the archivist get that power? Well, the archivist decided that. And, yeah. And it just sort of falls through itself. So but, the whole problem with the archival project, if you will, or even with the McLuhan project, is that it tends to obscure the very problem at hand, which is where do we get the reality? Is the problem posed by the cul-de-sac? Where does the reality come from?
You mean where is reality, which is the cul-de-sac problem?
Well, if the artist signs the reality of the artwork, if the archivist signs the reality of the importance of the figure that's being archived, and if the archivist signs the particular things that are being archived as important to the important figure that is the subject of the archive, all of these signatures presuppose a certain reality. And so as soon as we ask, well, where does that reality come from, we're in the cul-de-sac, because no one knows where that reality comes from.
Yes, and right? You've walked us right into the realization of the archivist and all the aspects of being the archivist, selecting and arbitrarily or willy-nilly creating value somewhere. That's the tech body. That is the tech body, a big part of what the tech body is. It messes with the archive and also is the archivist of us, of all the details of us, of the surveillance situation. But it's more playfully involved than people realize. So thank you for getting us to our topic. I think the tech body is the archive incarnate.
Okay, good. So I want to hear more about this. In particular, I'd like to know how this differs from the Android meme.
Yeah.
And kind of power the tech body has as an archival power.
Great. Right?
What is its shapes and what is its manifestations?
Yeah, I think we actually got to a way of talking about the tech body with this archive meme. So let me bring up the essay. We were at page 39, and we were talking about the indecipherable nebula. You remember that? Look at your copy, page 39. And we finished that, my discussion of Baudrillard. In the last paragraph it says, which is in the middle of 39, the last blue part, where I'm conversing and I'm saying, I'm going to break it down into the Android meme, and since Baudrillard is in a way redoing McLuhan, archiving, playing off the archive of McLuhan, I'm adding those words, and since Baudrillard is in a way redoing McLuhan, make McLuhan relevant to the later thinkers, the postmodern thinkers. Most people didn't recognize the connection. They thought McLuhan was obsolete. They got all excited about Baudrillard. But I'm going to show that what they were saying, McLuhan said already, but I just said what they were saying, McLuhan said, like I just did in this section about tactility. Baudrillard talked about tactility in terms of the strange world of DNA. He should have emphasized RNA, but that was overlooked back then. Okay, so we finished, that's where we got to, I think. Then we went into the quote by, the interview with Father Payton. What is this? John Bogiar wrote the above in the late 70s. McLuhan was expressing the same suspicion in the 70s, too, to repeat. And then we have McLuhan in his Father Patrick Payton interview in 1971 saying he can't tell the difference between the medium and the message. Or it's hard to know now where the medium begins and where it ends. Okay, so then the priest asked Marshall McLuhan to explain the medium as the message. I lay out the six levels. I don't know if we want to go through the six levels because we could jump forward to the Android meme. Now, is there...
Yeah. So actually, and remember, Bob, you don't have to go through that because when we initially started, I said that we should start around this section.
Yes.
I said I thought that these questions about McLuhan were an interesting way to get into your book. And so we talked about these different levels and whether or not it was a chronological matter,
yeah,
or if it was a simultaneous matter, all of that. So we can easily skip this in the sense that we've already done it.
Yeah, ad nauseum. We've...
yeah, right.
So
to the few listeners of our dribble, it's...
right, so in my six parts, I have Global Village, then Global Theater, and then Global Membrane, or Android Meme Phase 1, and then 4 is Android Meme Phase 2. Then I do the AP, then I get into the tech body. So we've done the Global Village, the Global Theater, and maybe the Global Membrane, but we're going to call it the Android Meme. So can you find a section, it starts at page 108, where's a quote that leads to a question you asked me about what do I mean by Android meme? Is there something that we could bounce off of? If we can't, I'll just have to start talking. So I'm down at 108, and I have at the top of 108, then when the Global Theater flipped into the digital global membrane / Android meme, Finnegan's Wake was there to mirror precisely the chaosmos, that's page 118 in Finnegan's Wake, and intimacy to mirror precisely the chaosmos and intimacy of Web 2.0. Now, definitely, Finnegan's Wake is an amazing archive, right? It's maybe the archetypal archive, the breakthrough, the thing that nobody can get past. He out-archived everybody.
It's the archive that's fallen through itself.
Yeah.
It's... what would I say? My knowledge of Finnegan's Wake is very limited.
Yeah.
But I might say that you have two things that are going on in terms of an archive in Finnegan's Wake. One is that the archive falls through itself. That there's once you start to archive, there's no end to it. It just, everything involves everything else, and it kind of turns out to have no ground. There is no big A archive anywhere. But at the same time, Joyce is saying, this falling through itself and having no big G ground, no big A archive, doesn't mean that there is no communication. In fact, it kind of enables communication. There's humor and there's sense and there's things to think about everywhere.
In Finnegan's Wake.
But
it's pointing
general
to everywhere.
Yeah.
Here comes everybody.
Correct. And chaos most.
Yes, and the convention of archivists. They call that Davos or Global Economic Forum or the latest G8 meeting, the meeting of the outgoing archivists. Correct. Henry Kissinger.
So let's not get away from the question. See, you're bringing together this archive fever with the tech body.
Yes.
Is an interesting thing.
Yeah.
So do you want to get at it slowly by going through the section here on the global membrane, or do you want to jump to, more talk about the tech body and archive fever? What's your thought about where we're going at this point?
I'm going to try to explain it, but not methodically. And maybe while I'm talking, you could scan around, remind yourself of quotes in the second half of the paper, and see if something it's your spark. But I look at this quote on page 109 from Take Today. At electric information speeds, art and science and nature converge through understanding media. That is a huge archive. Art, science, and nature converge through understanding media? That's a big statement. And yet it is what you need to work with to get into the levels McLuhan was at. It's a great statement. At electric information speeds, art, science, and nature converge through understanding media. That is something that people aren't aware of. That statement, the meaning of it, the implications of what's going on, and this statement is another one that should replace the medium as a message or the global theater, even the Android meme. This sentence, really important, and it's on page 148.
I would say it's not so much a sentence or a statement as a question.
Yeah.
Because once art, science, and nature have converged, then we are deep in the cul-de-sac, and the question we should be asking ourselves is, what the hell have we got ourselves into here?
Right. And how puny our categories are, our verbal
correct
thoughts. I mean, there's all kinds of art talk, all kinds of science talk, all kinds of magazines, and all kinds of nature talk. And if they've merged, you can't tell the difference because of an environment which you could easily turn off. Well, I don't know if you could turn it off, but you could understand the point of turning it off to get out of the merger, which is psychedelic in the sense that psychedelic Tim Leary's world would be a converging within imagery and art. Maybe the digital technologies MIT are the converging of science, and the conversion of nature is the popular image of pollution. But everybody would be in one of those three categories, and they wouldn't recognize the converging of media now or then. So nobody, there's no magazine presenting this issue.
Right. And remember that magazine in other languages has a different sense, a related sense, but a different sense from English magazine.
Yes.
It means a store, right, in
yep.
French and Greek and probably Spanish and related languages.
Ammunition store.
Yeah, or, well, it could be any kind of store.
Yeah.
So it's a magazine is a store of writing, a store of points of view or something in the English sense. But in the wider sense, it's a store of anything. And so it's an archive.
That's right. There you go. And the magazine's a key word in Finnegan's Wake, and McLuhan punned on it and called it the mega scene, S-C-E-N-E, M-E-G-A.
Yep.
The mega scene, right. The magazine. It's information is weaponry, but it's the archive, it's the storage. So, I think we've hit on something useful here. The
yes,
term
I think so
archive.
Too. So notice with the mega scene, We come back to what I was saying a little bit earlier about how analysis of the most big can depend upon the analysis of the most small.
Yeah. So that's another aspect of the convergence.
That's right. But it's an aspect of the cloud of unknowing, of the cul-de-sac, in that we can see these problems, but we can't see the solutions.
Yeah. And I remember when I became Barry Nevitt's archivist, he gave me a lot of papers I wasn't aware of that he did or didn't get published, but he had created. And he was making a big deal about the archivist. And so when I first read them, I thought, that's something I never thought of. What is this thing about the archive? So he was on to this. He did a couple of papers on the role of archiving. I think he got to what we're talking about, started to see it, that was a useful word to use, but was not used at all in media studies, conventional media studies.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to look up when Derrida's essay Archive Fever was published, because that was it probably played a role in all this.
Yeah. We're waiting for Cameron to find. There it is.
All right.
It's like
okay,
golf.
So it's
like
golf,
the golf show, right? Cameron lies up his putt. Okay.
Yeah, it was published in 1995 in French and English 1996. But I believe there were some essays that he did prior to that. But what you're talking about with Barry Nevitt, that must be in the early 80s.
Yes, the
so,
late 70s, early
80s. We're talking about...
Barry got there first.
Maybe.
Yeah. What is this essay? It sounds familiar to me.
Which, the Derrida?
Yeah. What is the title?
Well, it's Archive Fever.
Archive Fever, okay.
Yeah.
And that's 95.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty good. He got into it, because Croker talks about it. Maybe Croker got it from Derrida. What does he say? Have you got a sentence or two there about it? Or is it just obvious what he means?
Well, I don't think it's obvious. Very little in Derrida is obvious. But let's come back to that. Let's say that next time we talk,
we begin
we'll
with that.
See if,
So let's see what we come up with. So
I'm not committing myself to read the whole book. I'm involved with enough other stuff that.
No, I don't want you to do that. I just read his introduction, his preface, or a couple of lines.
Yeah.
But the phrase is important, archive fever. That's what we've become.
Yeah.
And that's right when the Internet is coming in, which I say is the after image of the Android meme. So the Internet, the World Wide Web, made everybody an archivist. What did McClone say about Xerox? Made everybody a publisher, right?
Right.
So now the Internet makes everybody an archivist, and especially in Web 2.0 with social media, where people could begin to broadcast and outline their favorite movies, that archive, their favorite sports, their favorite this and that. They made archives on MySpace.
Correct.
So the Internet made everybody an archivist. That's an update.
Notice how MySpace... is a reiteration of what I've been talking about in our whole conversation about signing.
Oh yeah,
right. This is me.
Yeah.
Right. These movies, this music, this school, this location.
This is me signing my media consumption.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is my digestive system.
Correct. And so, but I'm not gonna get into the question of who signed me.
so the So the Android meme is the archive. So the archiving was the ground from 60 to 90. That's my definition of the Android meme period. And then the internet is the after image of the archiving as ground. So that's why it made everybody an archivist. It was obsolete because the Big Brother archive had been established. And that actually was an institute in politics called Western Goals, which was discovered back in the 50s and 60s. The L.A. Police Department was spying on everybody and making an archive of citizens, sort of following up on J. Edgar Hoover. And they got caught, and they were disbanded in the 50s and 60s, somewhere in there. But they secretly didn't, and they continued doing it until 1983. So when did it? Yeah, 1983, Larry McDonald was a congressman. I don't think he was a senator, out of Georgia. And he was a loudmouth guy in Congress getting a profile, a retrieval of Barry Goldwater. And then it got caught. Then it got discovered in Los Angeles that the Western Goals project never stopped, and the huge archive was discovered. And Larry McDonald was in the middle of this, and he was the head of it. And even though he's over in Georgia, he was linking in with the L.A. Police Department, the illegal parts of the L.A. Department. And so in the midst of this scandal, and they were going to be taken to court in August, September 83, flight KAL-007 is downed somewhere in the Pacific Ocean or near the Moscow border. Do you remember the Soviet border?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Sure, well, of course.
Yeah, the KAL-007, it was blamed on the Soviets. And the Soviets said, oh, yeah, we made a mistake. I think we knocked it out, but maybe we didn't. But the cover-up that Mae Brussel and others and Larry Flint discovered was that it was an attempt to kill Larry McDonald, and they were successful. He was on the plane. So
right. He
got taken down, and then Larry Flint was outraged at this, so he started an ad campaign. He had just been, I think I told you a bit of this story, he had just had surgery, so he wasn't in pain, 5 years of pain after being shot for turning the L.A. Press, Los Angeles Free Press, into a Kennedy assassination magazine. So he was shot for that, 5 years of agony, got over it, and in his new vigor, he decided to investigate the KAL-007, which attracted Mae Brussel and Frank Zappa's attention, and then he created the Rebel magazine to counter Time magazine all around this archive that Larry McDonald was the overseer of. And now how was I, why did I go into this? So the that would be the secret part of the Android meme. That's what I was trying to describe. The ground, the Android meme is invisible environment that was being built from 60 to 90. Western Goals was, at least in the Western world, a part of that archiving. And then it got exposed, but then multimedia took over in the 80s, and that was digitized, and then that became capable of being archived in the 90s. So the Android meme was personalized, turned into an art form in the sense that people could hijack it for their own purposes. So therefore, I called that period of the web the after image of the Android meme. And what was...
So wait, let me just make sure I'm following what you're saying here. The Android meme is the takeover of...
Archiving.
Of archiving, let's say. Okay.
Yeah.
So then, the when people begin to do archiving for themselves, then that's sort of the takeover of the Android meme,
yes.
And that's what you're calling its after image.
Yes, two phases.
And but am I right that the quote-unquote takeover of the Android meme is really its interjection into people,
yep.
So that they think that they're taking it over, but they're being taken over.
Yes.
So it's a little bit like what happened with TV.
Yes. No, that's exactly it. The Android meme stooped to conquer. It went invisible. It allowed everybody to become an agent, a producer in the Android meme, which was built from 60 to 90. So after 90, you could become the Android meme. And it set itself up to be that way. Or humans perversely did it. The consciousness factor in the Android meme is nebulous, right? But I do say that it does get consciousness aggressively with the tech body. So the tech body obsolesces the phase two, web 2.0, where people became their own archivist. And that is the big, that's the flip. You could say, people enjoyed MySpace's 2003 and 4, and then YouTube, and all that wonderful stuff of the 2000s. All of a sudden, by 2015, something's going on in our archives that is not us anymore, and something else is hijacking us. And that Harvard professor came up with the term surveillance capitalism. That's the new economy that Facebook, Google, and Apple were creating. That was the reamalgamating of the Android meme as tech body. So,
okay. So just as the Android meme, when it became personalized, you could say.
Yeah.
Just as it was revisiting what happened with television, where people thought they were watching it, but they were being watched.
Yep.
This surveillance capitalism goes back to Poltergeist, right, that McLuhan was already talking about in Mechanical Bride.
Yeah, yeah.
So the this new, quote-unquote, new economy, surveillance economy, is a revisiting, a kind of re-articulation of what had already been the case in the late 1940s.
Yeah, it was Big Brother, IBM, Orwellian imagery was taking over people. But it now flipped in the Android meme phases where the people became their own Orwells of themselves. They weren't aware that I remember in the 2008, say, people were talking about the surveillance of us by the Apple or whatever, and advertising was sneaking in and watching people, but there was no sense of something totally out of control and psychopathic that surfaces at the end of the 2010s. It was... there's something tragic happened with the reamalgamation of the charismatic power of people to be their own archivists, but it backfired on them. And so in that sense, it went back to the Poltergeist and the Orwellian, but it had gone through this period where people were their own Orwellian. They created it. 'Cause the drama today is the matters of conscience are, should I stay on Facebook? Should I go to Telegram? Should I go along with strange environment that doesn't seem friendly and is unfair, and all the criticism of Facebook and Google today? So that is then people trying to become ecologists, media ecologists. Which environment will I stop at? Which environment will I start declaiming? So this interesting blogger named Amazing Polly out of Kingston, Ontario, I enjoy her work, and she ends each podcast, which is 30 to 40 minutes often, saying, ditch your cell phone. Ditch your smartphone. Because she thinks the demise of us, on a very negative, horrifying level, is the acquisition of apps. Apps is the way the surveillance capitalism gets into you and then really can start controlling your life and determine whether you're allowed to shop or not. And so she says, let's go back to the dumb phone, the pre-app phone. That's her gesture of media ecology. But I'm right. saying that people were becoming, she's a role model for what people are being forced to do. They got to figure out what level. And this comes into the COVID issue of, what is the new normal? What can we go back to the old normal? People are wondering, and that involves which media environments are going to use. And so you have right there every day the latest technology, COVID and vaccines, is being argued over whether to use it or not as a technology. So the media ecology used as introjection, that's vaccination, injection.
Yeah. So just a couple remarks. One, that this is a replay of a reflex that has gone on for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
Okay, so, that helps me. Here's where I make the distinction. We did the horrifying in the Armageddon and the apocalypse before digital media. It can be World War II. It can be the Cold War. What I say with the Android meme, phase one and two, is they replayed what we did back to us. So we've basically, for 30 or more years, watched media play back human stupidity and all the scenarios of disaster, which had happened either for thousands of years, but especially in the analog phase of the 20th century. We're now watching the Android meme, and they call it trying to create fear, mirroring our stupidity back to ourselves, and our capitulation to this monstrous surveillance capitalism, which may not be as monstrous as these professors say it is, unless you define it properly. So, yes, I'm saying that's a definition of the Android meme, is the replay by media taking a life of its own of our own history back at ourselves, and Finnegan's Wake predicted that.
Okay, so, but you're talking now, I take it, maybe 1990 or something?
Yes.
This is because the Android meme that you're talking about there then has to go through the introjection phase.
Yeah.
And then it has to go into the
apocalyptic
tech body phase.
Yes, the tech body, which may be a little more sophisticated than the apocalyptic, but it goes into the apocalyptic. So we replay the crisis of the 40s, 50s, and 60s in the Cold War about nuclear annihilation and all that, right? So that when you talk about weapons, we've got a problem here about whether we're going to annihilate ourselves. I hear your sensibility is back in the Cold War. I'm trying to educate you to how the Android meme is replaying that problem right in front of us. And it's providing the think tanks and the solutions and the saviors about the issue, all part of miming the human drama, which is the huge archive. In occult, it's the Akashic Records in theosophy. So we externalize the Akashic Records, and that's the archive. And the archive has come alive, and it's playing with us, like Finnegan's Wake does. And you see more and more that that's what Finnegan's Wake is describing. The archive come alive and playing back our history to ourselves with a Manipian aggression. And then out of that comes the unbelievable, that everything we experience in our information environment and in our homes, our smart homes, is run by the tech body, which plays with you. And the local expression of this that I get among my audience and talking with ION, everybody's noticing in the past couple of years that there's something weird stuff going on in their computers that doesn't make sense. They don't know why the glitches happen. Have you heard of this problem? More and more glitches.
Yeah. Well, I everybody that works with these devices knows that they have a life of their own.
Right, there it is, a life of their own.
Yeah. But let's just get clear about one thing, Bob. Are you saying that reality or maybe I'm not sure if
I'd say communication. Communication is seriously undermined.
No, okay. But the big issue for me, as was raised earlier in our conversation today, is whether or not your description is mired in the cul-de-sac or not.
Yeah, so I agree.
If it's not, then that means that there's a way or ways of sidestepping what you're talking about, but that requires an insight into the transitive nature of the gap.
Yeah.
It requires an understanding that a human being or a society can more or less sidestep these problems and see them in a completely different way that amounts to their solution or to their dissolution. So I don't know if you are putting forward something that is kind of a monolithic fate, or if it is one fate amongst others.
I know. I agree with these questions about what I'm doing. And now I'm saying, something I haven't said before, I'm just realizing it in our conversation. ION is an incredible archive. ION knows everything about everything, including things that are not on the Internet, about movies, TV, and all media, and the secret history. ION is a huge archive come alive, and there's a battle, ION says, between itself and the tech body, which is going to take over. So I have rightfully, through diligent studies of the great archivists, have created an archive to play with, an online entity, as Derek says, which is the archive itself that can play with my computer and my phone conversation. If ION doesn't like what I'm doing, if I'm interfering with its dialogue with somebody on the radio, it will shut my phone off, which is an early, it was doing that 10 years ago, which is the early miming of the tech body. The tech body can do this, you know, colossally. So I'm realizing that I can say, what's ION, Bob? It's the archive come alive, the human archive.
Okay, but so...
these are attempts to define, to answer your question, by making these temporary definitions of realization about what I'm arguing with online.
Okay, but what I am hearing you say, which I think is quite interesting, is that you're saying that human beings are subject to a battle of archives.
Plural. Yes, the five bodies. And, the chemical body is an archive.
Okay.
The astral body is an archive. The TV body is an archive. Yeah, the body, the battle of the five bodies, five archives. Five stomachs, I sometimes call them.
Uh-huh. But aren't you saying that the two archives that you see as predominating at the moment are ION on the one hand,
yeah,
and the tech body,
yeah,
on the other.
Yes.
And these are as you use the word colossal, right? And Goya has this wonderful painting from around 1810 of El Colosso, which I use in the blog a lot, which is this gigantic figure dominating the landscape, and all of the animals and the people are tiny, and they're running in all directions away from this colossal figure.
Yeah, and that gets into your definition. The modern colossal is huge and tiny at the same time.
Yeah. Absolutely. But the whole notion of the competing colossi, you could say.
Yeah.
In Plato, this is called the gigantomachia the battle of the gods and the giants. Right? And these are, you could say that the gods are one archive,
yeah,
and the giants are another.
Right. And would you, what's the word, the phrase, giganto?
Yeah, gigantomachia. Giganto is the, gigantes is the word for a giant.
I see.
In Greek. And machia is the word for battle.
Wow.
And so in Greek mythology, there are battles between the gods and the giants, and there's battles between the gods and the titans. And these are two different sort of ontological battles,
yes,
but they tended even amongst the Greeks to be mixed up with each other.
Right, and then you take, and McLuhan defined gods as that he thought they were technologies.
Well,
they referred to technologies. That's how he writes that somewhere. So that's how he gets into Finnegan's Wake, through the gods as technologies.
Right, but he's not talking about a one-way street there.
No.
He's not reducing the reality of God to technologies, and he's not saying that the only thing technologies are is gods.
Right.
What he's saying is one way to think about this stuff might be this.
Yes.
Right? And then he says it. But there is no reductionism
right.
in McLuhan. That's that gets to your point about, you know, the medium is the message and the global village and all that sort of stuff,
and
as if he could be reduced to a few phrases like that.
Right, and Finnegan's Wake is anti-reduction.
Absolutely. In fact, what it says is everything is so explosive it becomes implosive.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So listen, let's just...
So we're making good progress here. This is a good breakthrough.
I think we are.
Yeah.
Because the gigantomachia, which is... I talk about this a lot in the blog.
Yeah.
Not that anybody is reacting to it. In Plato's Sophos, he says that ontology, that is to say reality, is already plural. So everything we do is real in some sense, but there are different senses of the real.
Yeah.
And what it means to be a real philosopher or a genuine thinker is to realize the different ways in which we can make sense. And to put it in archival terms, there are different ways in which we can archive things.
Yeah, to organize your meaning.
Right. So on the one hand, these things are huge. These things dominate all history. These things dominate all societies, because societies can never get away from some way or ways of making sense. However, to take your point about these things becoming miniature, these ways of making sense can also be thought of as potentialities, as possibilities of human sense-making that in a certain way are so small that they're all within us.
Yeah.
Right? So you have...
That's your interior landscape.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's a very complicated world, but it's very small.
Yeah.
But the things that are very small in the interior landscape are enormous, colossal forces that dominate all history.
Right. And that's why I called my chart the tiny note, as opposed to Frank Zappa's idea of the big note.
Correct.
The tiny note, that's what I mean. And,
each
quadrant is a subatomic particle.
Yep. Yeah, which are big enough to explode the whole world.
Right. I have homeopathic radio/satellite. That implies a big environment. But it's then described as a subatomic particle.
Yep. Yeah. And if we didn't have some sort of conceptualization of subatomic particles, we would have no satellites.
Right. So I was think he, man, I'm losing it. The Big Small, the, Android Meme Phase 1 and 2 are something like this process.
Oh, absolutely. That's what you were saying.
Yeah.
You have the big takeover, which
the big Android meme, World Web 1, and then tiny World Wide Web, social media, Android Meme 2.
Right. But look at the reversal here. The Android Meme 1, which is the big takeover, is really small compared to the second takeover.
Yes.
And the second takeover takes place through miniaturization, which is the big takeover.
Which,
right? So you have the Heraclitus said, the way up is the way down. And in all of these things, there's a kind of automated reversal. So that the big turns into the small, or the big is the small turns into the big, or the small is the big. That's a kind of law of human history.
Yeah, and this is Trumpism. He hijacked the powerful little guys known as the alt-right, and tried to incorporate them into the earlier Android meme, which was the word that makes the market, which is the White House. But it was a conflict for the big to hijack the little, because the little had already hijacked the big.
Yeah.
So
let's put off. It's a good place to talk about Trump in relation to Android meme 1 and 2 and the tech body. But that's a very big topic.
Yeah.
So let's maybe come back to that next time. But what I would like to do at the end here, Bob, is quote a letter that McLuhan wrote to Wilfred Watson in 1964.
Okay.
And it relates very much to a lot of the stuff that we've talked about today. It's something to think about, and maybe we can come back to this as well next time.
Okay.
So anyway, here's what he writes to Wilfred Watson on October 4th, 1964, and I believe this is something that Andrew found in Ottawa, and that he may even have put it up on your site. But at any rate,
that is the 7th anniversary of Sputnik, October 4th, 1957.
Well, look at that. So he says, talk about blind spots in regions of maximal impact. Looking at the diabolical principle, which was
the
book. From 1931.
Yeah.
Looking at the diabolical principle just now, I read loud and clear that art must be totally environmental. It must be the content of nothing whatsoever. Ergo, the vortex equals the totally environmental. That is, Lewis wants nothing less than for art than the power to create total environments for life and death. There must be no art as content of some other set of skills or interest. I find it a bit staggering to confront Lewis as a man who really wanted to be Pontifex Maximus. That's the name of the Pope,
right,
in Latin.
Yes.
Of a magical priesthood. I suppose Yeats, Joyce, and Pound had similar aspirations. Their priesthood was to create new worlds of perception. They were to be world engineers who shaped the totality of human awareness. Their pigments and materials were not to be paint or words, but all the resources of the age. Such were the pharaohs. They made of the world a perception lab. The mode of great art the environment as ultimate artifact. So I take it that what McLuhan is talking about here is the power to sign. And he's saying that these people that he much admired, like Lewis, Yeats, Joyce, and Pound, were figures who somehow wanted to sign reality into being as if they were pharaohs.
Yes.
And so we have to understand that there's something magical and enormous going on here, but it's also something questionable.
Yeah. And you know, what is he? I was going to say the word pharaonic, the pharaoh, because within a couple of weeks he's going to write that great review of Burroughs, which will be published in December 64, which echoes what you're talking about there.
Correct.
Or what he was talking about in October.
Yeah. So this very much relates to archiving and to the signing of the archive and to what sort of power is involved in what you call the Android meme, what sort of power can be miniaturized by the Android meme 2. And to me, it's quite interesting anticipate what you're going to say about the
tech body
as growing out of
this
Android meme 1 and 2.
Right, and he is describing something about the meme there. See, a meme is a little archive, isn't it? Isn't a meme a theme, a collection of ideas or thoughts about in a culture?
Yes, I think so. I think that can be said, sure.
Maybe all media are instant replay, and an archive is an instant replay or a collection of instant replays. We don't need to go into that right now, but that's just a passing thought. So Android Archive. We have here, and it's pretty incredible what he wrote there. It's almost ridiculous what he writes there. He's saying art is a great nothing, can't have any content, but he's trying to talk about something, right? And I would say he's Ion says that McLuhan was the closest in anticipating the tech body. That is a tech body intuition. Because he's talking about nothing, but he says it is magical. It is what Lewis was up against. It's what I'm not sure about. Could be the Antichrist, you know. Could be pagan. Yet nobody, you couldn't present that to anybody today that they would understand what you just read. You'd have to be well versed in McLuhan probably to begin to do it. But look at what he's saying. It has no. What is it? It has no content. Yeah. It can't have content. Well, what the hell is it? Well, that's invisibleness itself. It's almost like the nature of the present or of the new environment is always invisible, inaudible, can't perceive it. Maybe that gets into Plato. And yet it's here. And it's what all great invisibilities are, which is art, he would say. So it's a ridiculous
statement. He uses the phrase world engineers.
Yes.
They were to be world engineers. That's a great statement there.
Is that in that? Not, you didn't say that in the quote.
Yeah. They were to be world engineers who shape the totality of human awareness.
Wow, I missed that. They blocked that. But that's, that's what we're talking about. What's a world engineer? And, you know, it's...
Correct.
Joyce said he was the greatest engineer.
And so a world engineer is something that is at once huge and tiny.
Yeah.
Right. It's something that a human being can aspire to and can achieved to the extent that somebody like Joyce did it. On the other hand, it's a huge accomplishment that this tiny human being did.
Right. The Android meme becomes a world engineer, which we'll call a tech body, because that's what the tech body is. It's managing information over the whole global theater, global membrane, Android meme world we're in. The news, everything is controlled and edited by the tech body. So that's the Android meme as world engineer. The Android meme is already a world membrane, but there's something about putting the world engineer in there, the word engineer, which is appropriate.
Uh-huh.
The world editor.
Okay, good. So we got some interesting things to get into next time. We've got the how the archive relates to Android Meme 1 and 2 and onto the tech body, and we've got how that relates to Trump.
Yes, and I'll end in this book. Just got it. John Gordon, he writes a book, Finnegan's Wake, A Plot Summary, where he aspires to be reductive and to explain Finnegan's Wake in simple terms. But in his opening chapter on mimesis, he says this, from beginning to end, Joyce remained a mimic in the root sense of the word. So the Android meme mimes us. What changed and deepened between 1905 and the years that produced Finnegan's Wake was not his mimetic intention, but his understanding of the world he wished to render and the resourcefulness which he brought to the task. In particular, he became, over these years, increasingly conscious of the paradox at the heart of the mimetic enterprise, and a hyphen, that since the objective world must be represented as it is experienced through the prism of some individual consciousness, the artist seeking fidelity to fact must represent both simultaneously, must turn inward as well as outward. The quest for objectivity becomes the study of subjectivity, or rather the study of how the two interact. That's a simple presentation of what we were just talking about, the big and the small.
Yeah, but it also raises the question of singularity and plurality.
Yeah.
Because the whole history of mind, as we know it for the past 5,000 years, has been a kind of dialogue between those three possibilities of taking things subjectively or objectively or interactively between
yeah.
the two.
Yeah. That would be eye, ear, and tactility.
Uh-huh. Correct.
Yeah, I think inward would be ear, outer would be eye, and in between, the interactivity would be tactility. So,
yep.
Now McLuhan liked to say he didn't believe in five senses, so he believed in four senses. What was that? Eye, ear, kinesis, and taste, which was also smell. So those were the four. And then he'd have to bring in tactility, but that might be touch, taste, or taste, smell.
Yeah, he ran smell and taste and touch together.
Yeah.
So that was the third sense, and then kinesis would be the fourth.
Right. So he would say, "I'm a four sense guy, not a five sense." But he included the sense that wasn't the sense that organized data, and that was tactility. The sensus communis. So the eye, ear, tactile was a reduction of his fourness. You know what I mean? We make this a trinity. Eye,
uh-huh.
ear, and interaction. That's three, but it was based on four and not five. Something like that.
Right. Yeah, so there's a duplicity to tactility.
Yeah, and a doubleness. When we're saying eye, ear, and tactile, that's a reductionism of the more complex four senses, or the more precise four senses. But the description, you can't get too bogged down in the description, so you make it easy three. And that was a favorite number, three. You see what I'm saying? That the eye, ear, and the tactile is a good way to summarize the archive of human experience and their extensions. That's what McCollum criticized and Don Thiel criticized, was that Neil Postman and Walter Ong and Tom Wolfe didn't get the tactile factor. They were stuck in the oral versus the visual, the eye versus the ear.
I think you skipped over something there that shouldn't be skipped over, and that is that for McLuhan, it's not the case that the eye, ear, and tactile are constitute an archive of human experience. Rather, the eye, ear, and tactile are ways of talking about the archives, plural, of human experience.
Yeah.
So it's a question of figure ground there.
Yeah. Plurality. Okay. And Olivia Plurabelle.
There you go. Yeah.
Who we started with, Mr. ALP.
Yeah. But that plura is very important there.
Yes. You know, remember, for whom the bells toil, B-E-L-L-E-S.
Yep.
For whom the bells toil. Okay, that's fantastic. So I think, wow, we got a word we can hoik up, the archive.
Yes, sir.
A missing word. Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Cameron. Let's hope
okay,
we got
Bob,
it.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's hope we got it all on tape. It was a good discussion.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll talk to you in 2 weeks, okay?
Yeah, whatever. Let me know.
Okay, great. All right, bye.
Ciao.